how do we respond to this? How should we respond to this? How can we respond to this? Obviously, there's an enormous amount of education that needs to be done. An awful lot of undoing of the kind of information, misinformation, propaganda, thinking that is propagated in the United States by the government, by the press, by Fox Television, by CNN, by talk radio. Enormous amount of work that has to be done. And it seems to me, you know, if there's something central about what needs to be done, it is to bring alive the idea, restore the idea, which I think exists inside people, but which is suppressed by the culture and the propaganda around them, the idea that there's nothing special about the United States, nothing special about Americans. Oh, you can find trivial things that are special about us, but in the really important things, we are like all other people in the world. And we should behave as we expect other people to behave. The golden rule should apply, you know. No. I think this is not a new idea for people. I think most people, I mean, there may be a small number of weird people who will never be persuaded, you know, but I think most people have inside them a feeling of common interest, not just with Americans, but with people all over the world. And I think it's a very natural thing for people to feel that people everywhere are brothers and sisters if they speak a different language. If there's a hurricane in 5,000, 10,000 miles away, no, those victims are like our victims. And the idea, the children everywhere in the world are like our children. And if we wage war and we kill children in another country, it's like killing our own children. It's such a simple idea. The Declaration of Independence, that we're all created equal and endowed, yes, by our Creator. This is where, I think, maybe this is invoking God in a decent way. Endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This doesn't apply to just Americans, but this applies to everywhere, and the people everywhere in the world have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what social movements try to do. Social movements, movements against war, movements for the rights of women, movements for the rights of black people, movements for the rights of gay and lesbian people, for the rights of disabled people. What do these movements try to do? They try to say to everybody, we're all one. We all have the same interests. We all need the same things. We all need peace. We all need decent housing and health care and food and shelter. All of us, everybody in the world. And the idea of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948 as a sort of a, you might say, a high exultant moment after World War II, the idea was that, yeah, everybody in the world deserves these fundamental things. So it's a matter of reminding people of what is already in them, bringing out, you know, what is already in them. And in fact, this is being done. That is, there is action going on all over this country against war, for the rights of women, for the rights of poor people, for the rights of immigrants. There are more local groups in this country working for human rights all over the country, more today than, far more than there were in the 1960s. Well, a lot of people don't really understand this. It's a big country, and and people in one part of the country don't know what is going on in another part of the country. But for instance, you know, in this last, on the second anniversary of the beginning of the war, when there were anti-war demonstrations all over the country, there were anti-war demonstrations in parts of the country that had never seen an anti-war demonstration before. In little towns in Montana and Arkansas, a huge one in New Orleans, a huge one in Fayetteville, North Carolina. We don't hear about these things, but they're heroic people speaking up and acting, and all of those people in the religious pacifist movement who have been committing acts of civil disobedience, and very often recently been acquitted by juries when they had an opportunity to present evidence to the juries about the violations of international law by the United States. And this is discovered during the Vietnam War, when people put on trial and they have an opportunity to speak to the jury from the heart and to appeal to the common humanity of the jury and explain to the jury, now look, we're not just ordinary criminals. This is why we broke into this draft board. This is why we poured blood on these missiles. It has to do with life and death and war and peace and humanity. When they've been able to do that and present their arguments, juries have acquitted them. Suggesting that there is indeed a kind of inherent desire on the part of ordinary people to believe in the ultimate humanity of everybody. And I wanted to I have a whole file of examples of good things. I keep a file called Hope. because people, these things appear and they disappear and you don't even know they happened, and all these things that people do, which are wonderful things. Just the fact that down that the coalition of Immokalee workers that represents farm workers in southern Florida recently won a victory after years of struggle against this, you know, giant Taco Bell corporation. They finally won, you know, against them, you know. And I think of, you know, in this country, I think of the people in the military who are speaking up more and more. The soldiers who's coming back from Iraq, who formed the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. The families of soldiers in Iraq who formed a military family speak out. The Gold Star mothers who've lost children, lost, you know, their sons and daughters in Iraq, formed an organization speaking out against the war. And this is happening more and more. People in communities are going to high schools and informing high school students that their names are being given to military recruiters, and that they have a right to refuse to give their names and addresses to military recruiters. The military is having a hard time. You probably noticed. The military is having a hard time recruiting. They're getting desperate about recruiting. That's a good sign, you know. You know, and you find individuals doing sort of courageous things on their own. You know, a high school girl in West Virginia showing up in class with a T-shirt, you know, opposing the bombing that's going on, and you know, being expelled from her high school, but then appealing her case to the school board, and her mother, who was opposed to what her daughter was doing, showing up at a school board to defend her daughter. things like that happening, you know, all over the country and around the world. You know, the movement against genital mutilation in Africa is beginning to have some effect. There's civil disobedience in Nigeria against the big oil corporations that have been exploiting people there. I mean, you, you know that, you know, there's been a World Social Forum taking place in various parts of the world as a counter to this economic summit of the great financial giants of the world. And tens of thousands of people come to this World Social Forum from countries all over the world to protest against what globalization is doing to the human rights of people. I'm telling you all this just to suggest that you're not alone. It's very important. Sometimes I'm an auditorium even larger than this one of maybe 1,000 people, and somebody will raise a hand on the question board and say, "Well, why are, you know, where is everybody? There are 1,000 people here, and 1,000 people there, and 1,000 people there, and numbers grow. This is how movements grow. They start small, and they become big. And when they're small, they look hopeless. But if you look at the history of movements, if you look at the history, and I lived in the South, and was involved in the civil rights movement, you could see the development. You know, when things began in the South in the late 50s, you know, it looked hopeless for black people in the South. Eliminate racial segregation in the South, which has been here for so long. The white South totally dominates every aspect of Southern life, and the federal government is turning away and not really doing anything about it. It looked hopeless. People started to do things, and then other people started to do things, and then the sit-ins and the freedom rides and the demonstrations, and soon it became a national movement, and soon it came to the attention of the world, and then the policymakers in Washington had to respond. And you saw the same thing with the anti-war movement and the women's movement and so on. When those things happen, then democracy comes alive. I spoke about when we don't have democracy. We have democracy not when the government does something. We have democracy when citizens get together and force the government to do what it has been reluctant to do. And so democracy comes alive when social movements gather. And so we are in a position today where our problem is to bring democracy alive again and to reclaim the good name of America in the world to become part of the world community. It may take a little while, but things start small. And every little thing that you do is important. You know, people very often think, what heroic thing can I do that will change the world? No, you don't have to do heroic things. You just have to do something small. And if millions of people do something small, something begins to happen. And you have to be persistent and patient. Have faith that if enough people do enough small things, and we notice from history, something will happen. We've seen it happen in other parts of the world, surprising changes. We've seen it happen even in this country, things that we didn't expect to happen, and it can happen again. I want to end by coming back to Daniel Berrigan and reading one of my favorite poems of his. He wrote this in memory of a man in Washington, D.C., who had been an advocate of the homeless, a man named Mitch Snyder, and who had become really disheartened and killed himself. And he wrote this in memory of Mitchell Snyder. "Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart, and because of the bread, because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the risen bread." Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And now, question period. There's a microphone there in the middle. If you will come to the microphone, and I will answer anything on any subject.
It's okay if I don't use this because I'm not really big.
I don't care.
But
does anybody care?
This kind of off topic from what you were talking about, but they were the major reason I really read your writings. They introduced me to them. But can you describe your relationship with the band Pearl Jam? Because they really
describe my relationship with Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
All right. This is here's a little quiz.
In September.
Huh?
I went to the show in September that you were at
in Boston. Boston?
Yeah.
Did you go from Syracuse to Boston just to hear Pearl Jam?
Yeah.
Well, that tells you something about how many people here know what Pearl Jam is. Well, you're way ahead of me. Well, I know what it is now, but I confess, it's a terrible confession to make. A couple of years ago, I had never heard of Pearl Jam. It's really, I'm sorry. and then I got a call, a phone call from Eddie Vedder. Do you know who Eddie Vedder is? Well, now I know. Lead singer of Pearl Jam. You know. And he wanted to interview me. Interview Pearl. And then I looked him up, and I looked up Pearl Jam. Wow. You know, I thought I'd sold a lot of books. Selling a million books, 100 million CDs. And Pearl Jam, everybody, you know, of a certain age, and even of another age, knows Pearl Jam, except me. Anyway, Eddie Vedder was asked by Interview Magazine to interview somebody, and he had been introduced to my book, A People's History of the United States, by Tim Robbins, who was a fan of my book. And Tim Robbins told Eddie Vedder about my book, A People's History. Eddie Vedder read the book. He decided he wanted to interview me. He came to Boston. We met in a hotel room. He interviewed me. The interview appeared, and we became friends, and I now play rock music. Anyway, I'm very, very proud. He's a great guy, really. I mean, he's a guy, you know, one of the most famous singers and the greatest rock band in the country. And he has a social conscience. He cares about war and peace and human rights. And it's just there's a special. I believe there's a special thrill that comes from knowing that somebody who has a great talent in one of the arts, some great poet or writer or musician or actor or so on, that they, although they have it made and they could just rest content with the success in their field, that they care about what is going on in the world and they will do whatever they can to help. Anyway, that's my... So we're still in touch. And now I play his records. And a follow-up to that? I'm not sure I understand your question. How do we inform ourselves? Well, it's not easy, I grant. But it's being done. One of the ways it's being done despite the fact that the press and television doesn't really report on social movements and what they do. One of the ways it's being done is through the internet. Without the internet, it would not have been possible to organize simultaneous demonstrations all over the country to take place on one day. In fact, if you remember, on February 15th, 2003, on the eve of the war in Iraq, there were demonstrations around the world of 10 to 15 million people. One day. How did that happen? Happened. Only the internet made that possible. So this is one counter, a very important counter to the general control of the media. The internet today represents a remarkable democratic instrument which needs to be used more and more. It's a way of getting information to people. You go into the internet, and frankly, this is all fairly new to me. I mean, I have a son who's technologically adept, and without him, I probably wouldn't even have email, which would, of course, mark me as a, you know, to be exiled from the country or something. The internet, one, gives you information that you can't get anywhere else. You can go to the internet and get and see what is appearing in the London Guardian or in the Le Monde Diplomatique or the Get Dispatches from Agence France-Presse or from German newspapers, and you can or Middle Eastern newspapers, and you can get information from all over the world that doesn't appear in the American press. And so you can get information from the internet, and then you can use the internet to spread the information. I learned how to forward things. It seems, like a very primitive kind of education. But I learned how to forward things. I learned you could forward things to a lot of people if you think you have something really good to share with them. But, it's an uphill battle. There's no easy way, but and to a certain extent, it's and one part of the puzzle also is to have artists who reach a lot of people, musicians and actors who naturally reach large audiences, to have them speak out in some way, and some of them have been doing that. I do remember that. 3 hours. It's almost as long as this session.
Well, I was very impressed, but I've been looking for you.
No. You caught me. You caught me at the high point of my media life. C-SPAN. You say, but you look for me on NBC, ABC, CBS. Forget it. You look for Noam Chomsky or Barbara Ehrenreich or Naomi Klein, or you look for them. No. That tells you something about the media. The fact that I could even reach, I don't know how many people, maybe a million people on C-SPAN as opposed to reaching 20 million people on NBC, that was an accomplishment, you see. You can hear us. That is, those voices of dissidents and protest. You can hear us on community radio stations, on Pacifica, on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now. There are Pacifica radio stations in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Houston and Washington, D.C. and New York. And there are several hundred community radio stations around the country that will broadcast our things. There's an organization, there's a group called Alternative Radio. Any of you heard of Alternative Radio? There's a man in Boulder, Colorado named David Barsamian who runs this outfit called Alternative Radio. And he interviews people like us, outcasts, dissidents. He or sends his spies to record our lectures. And then he distributes these lectures and these interviews through satellite system to radio stations around the country. And some of them will pick it up and others won't. You're pointing, of course, to the reality of how the media keeps out voices that they are not happy with. There have been studies made of even the supposedly most liberal of the media, like the Lehrer NewsHour. And do you get the Lehrer NewsHour here? I mean, that's public television. There's no public on public television. You know, what do you get on the news, you know, the Lehrer NewsHour? You get ex-congressmen or present congressmen or dead congressmen. Or you get, you know, cabinet members. You know, you get generals, you get experts. You don't get the public. And their idea of a spectrum of opinion is from the extreme right to the dead center. You know, and so we have a lot of work to do.
So
yes.
There's no voice of the left. There's no voice of the left, really, on the mainstream.
No, there isn't.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I wanted to speak about that. We can all hear you, Professor, on a free radio from Colorado Barsimian's program. And I got one of the CDs from there, and I heard your wonderful talk about the arts in peacemaking. And I wish that if you had a few minutes just to talk about that book, Johnny Got His Gun. And if I would like to know if you would recommend to every college professor, every senior high school teacher, to share that book that would perhaps get over to children and do something to lessen the vast propaganda that the military tells them how war is going to be wonderful.
Mm. Well. How many of you have heard of the novel Johnny Got His Gun? Well, a nice number, not a majority, maybe 1/4 or 1/5. But everybody should know about it, and everybody should tell other people about it. It was a novel that I read when I was a teenager, and it exploded for me any notion I had that war could be heroic, a good cause, you know. And written by Dalton Trumbo, one of the Hollywood Ten, who was put in prison for refusing to talk to the House Committee on Un-American Activities about his political beliefs. But Johnny Got His Gun takes the abstraction of war and takes the kind of statement, a kind of formal statement, war is hell, and brings it down to the human level in the form of one person, one young man who goes off to war and comes back. Well, he's found on the battlefield, no arms, no legs, no eyes, no ears. The only thing that's left of him is a torso and a heart and a brain. And the book is all about, and they bring him in and they put him on a cot in a hospital. And the whole book is about his thoughts while he's lying. He can't communicate with the outside world. His thoughts about his past life, about growing up in a little town in the United States, about being sent off to fight for liberty and democracy. But then at a certain point, he learns how to communicate to a nurse who figures out how to communicate with him who can't speak or hear or has no arms or legs. And they communicate. And soon dignitaries come in to see this marvel. And they ask him through this nurse interpreter, what do you want? And his answer, I cannot possibly communicate to you. But one of the things he says, and it fits in with what this woman just said, one of the things he said was, take me out of here and take me to every classroom in the country. And, you know, and put me on the desk in every classroom in the country and say, this children, you know, this is war. Anyway, it's an amazing book. You can read it in one night. You should read it and tell other people about it. Yes. My World War II experiences. How many of you know? Notice how I keep taking polls? How many of you know that I was in the Air Force in World War II? Oh, quite a few of you know that. Oh, it was mentioned. You read about it somewhere. Okay. Well, a lot of lies have been told about me, but that is true. Yeah, I enlisted in World War II. I became a bombardier in the Air Force. I dropped bombs on various cities in Europe. I was an enthusiastic bombardier. I volunteered, I enlisted because I believed in, as most people in America do today, this is the good war. There are bad wars, but this is a good war. War against fascism. And in fact, you know, there was a moral core to World War II, which you don't find in a lot of other wars. Fascism, yes. But at the end of the war, I began to have different thoughts about good wars. And this was the best of wars. He was a vicious enemy, Hitler, a Mussolini, the fascism. Couldn't have a more vicious enemy. But I had realized I made a number of mistakes in my thinking. And there were things I didn't understand and didn't know. One of the mistakes I made was a kind of jump in logic. The jump in logic is this, that if you're fighting against evil, then you must be good. But in fact, we were not good. We were the British Empire. We were the American Empire. We were Stalin's Russia. Yes, there was evil on the other side, but it was not simply good versus evil. I learned something else, that you go into a war feeling they are the bad guys, you are the good guys. By the end of the war, you're behaving like the bad guys. War corrupts everybody. War poisons the soul. We can see this now in Iraq. See how young people are being poisoned by war, by violence. They're being made to hate people that they shouldn't hate. They're being made to torture people, you know. They're being made to do awful things. They're made to blow up automobiles with kids in them. War corrupts everybody. That's the conclusion I came to. And then I came to another conclusion that although there were problems, real serious problems in the world, war doesn't solve them. I mean, fascism was a problem, but war didn't solve the problem of fascism. Or racism, or militarism. We got rid of Hitler, got rid of Mussolini, got rid of the Japanese military empire. Did we get rid of war? Did we get rid of fascism in the world? Did we get rid of racism in the world? No. 50 million people were dead as a result of World War II, and where was the world now? We've had more people killed in wars since World War II than died in World War II. We've had war after war after war. I came to the conclusion that we're all susceptible to the quick fix of violence. Violence is sort of a quick way of getting rid of a problem, except that you don't get rid of the problem. And in the process, you become a problem. So I came to the conclusion that there's no such thing as a just war. And that, there are injustices in the world and there are terrible things that go on and nations will commit aggression against other nations and tyrannies will exist here and there, but the answer to that cannot be war. Because war is the indiscriminate killing of huge numbers of people, many of them children. In fact, in the wars of today, you know, the rate, and historically, the ratio of civilian dead to military dead in wars has gone higher and higher. No. In World War I, 10 military to one civilian dead. In World War II, it was about 50-50 military civilians. Vietnam, it was like 80% civilians and 20% military. And the percentage now is something like the same. So war is always a war against civilians. Not that soldiers, you know, they use the phrase innocent civilians. Soldiers are innocent too. It's not all right to, you know, oh, let's spare the civilians and kill the soldiers. Who are soldiers? They're poor, miserable conscripts, people who've been bamboozled into believing they should fight in a war or coerced and so on. They are the people who die. The leaders don't die. And so I came to the conclusion that with all the problems there are in the world, war is not the answer, and that maybe the great challenge before us in our time is to solve the problems of the world without killing lots of people. That's our problem. Yeah. Okay.